So this is part two. If you weren't here last week, you missed out on part one. We'll recap briefly. Very practical message. We often get quite theological, don't we? But sometimes we need a very practical message. How do we live our lives? So just to recap quickly from what we saw last week, that if we think of all the verses we know from the Bible about money, what we typically hear messages preached on, we came up with, what, I think 6, 7, 10 maybe on a good day. That would be represented by that little white dot there on the screen. But if you actually look at what the Bible really has to say on the subject of money, it's more like that. There's some 2,500 verses in the Bible on the subject of money, property, and wealth, and how to manage it. Clearly, this is something that's very important to God. So let's just recap quickly. I should actually say, just in case anyone is thinking, well, last week was just the warm-up and this is the hard sell, I'm not going to talk about tithes and I'm not going to talk about offerings, apart from them to mention them once at the end and remind you that I haven't talked about them, because they're in the small bit. And the Bible has a lot of other wisdom and advice on the subject of money. So we're going to be looking at that bit. So what we have looked at so far, the parable in Luke's Gospel, no man built a tower without first counting the cost. So we need to learn to live on a budget. Secondly, Proverbs 21, in the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil. And we looked at the idea of saving for short-term things and also saving for longer-term life events. So let's move on to number four, which is that we need to get out of debt. Is that in the Bible? Absolutely. And in fact, it's interesting that when God really wants to get the message across, there are many, many scriptures on this. And so we'll look at some in just a second. First of all, this one, Proverbs 22, verse 7, the rich rule over the poor and the borrower is slave to the lender. I wonder if someone who knew their Bible thought of naming MasterCard, MasterCard. But that's by the by. Okay. Let's define what a slave actually is. See, if you take a typical sort of picture like that, you think, well, here are these slaves, and they have a nice hut to live in, and they have clothes to wear. Do they own any of it?
No.
Okay. Now, that's the key element of being a slave. You work, and you work, and you work, and your master may well allow you to use that building to sleep in, or that donkey to do your work, but you don't own any of it. That's what being a slave means. I want to show you, using an example, how it is true that a borrower is a slave to the lender. Okay. True story. A young man who lived a couple of doors down from us, passed his driving test when he was 19, and in his mind, that meant that you pass your driving test in the morning and you go out in the afternoon and you buy yourself a lovely red hot hatch. Okay? Now, I don't think he quite factored in insurance, but he went down to Ford and he got a quote that went something like this. I think it was £3,700 down as a deposit and then £250 a month over 4 years. Okay. And so if you add up the sums, that means that 3 years in, he spent £12,500 on this car. And by the time he gets to the end of the 4 years, he spent £16,000 on this car. Yeah. You did maths, right? Okay. Now, there were a couple of problems with that idea, not including the insurance cost. The first problem was he didn't have £3,500. He'd just paid for his own driving lessons. He only had £2,000. The second problem was, both his uncle, who he lives with, and his auntie, they're both very astute business people, and they both looked at that and said, no. So this is what he did instead. He had £2,000, so he went out and bought himself a little Toyota. Okay, and he ran that around for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, he discovered two things about Toyotas. Sorry, Dennis. The first was, a Toyota is no young man's dream car. And secondly, they never go wrong, so he'd spent nothing on it except to have the paint touched up on the bumpers, because he'd bought off an old man with no miles but scratches. You know the sort of car we talk about, okay? Well, the result was that he also put aside £250 a month. His uncle sat him down and said, look, if you were willing to pay out £250 a month to some finance company, put £250 a month into the bank. Yeah? Okay. So at the end of a couple of years of driving that around, he turns up home in a four-year-old C-Class Mercedes. He's paid cash for it. How did he do that? Well, because if you do the sums, he's got a lot of money invested in this, hasn't he? 2 years, £6,000. He sold the Yaris for £2,500 because it's still low mileage, and he tidied up the bumpers and he got £500 more than he paid for it. Add the sums up. Yeah? And then, about 6 months later, he decided he didn't like the Mercedes. It was too much of an old man's car. And so he traded it in for a Vauxhall Astra VXR, 3 years old, just coming off finance. You do realise two things about Vauxhalls, although it is practically a supercar. Oh my goodness, fast. It still has a Vauxhall badge on the front, which means 3 years old, it's devalued like a brick falling off a building. And also, because on a good day he gets about 21 miles to the gallon, it's never been up and down the motorway, it's never taken the family on holiday, and it's hardly reached its first service in terms of mileage. It is near enough a new car. And that's what he's driving around still.
But is it Ford cars or is it
Well, there you go, I'm sure the Ford would be no better, but okay, this is the point. Have a look at this. 3 years in, what's he driving in each of those different routes? Well, he's driving a three-year-old hot hatch. But look at the difference in terms of how much it's costing. But now we get to the really interesting bit. Let's imagine that at the end of 4 years, his girlfriend arrives home and says, congratulations, yeah, we're going to be parents. Okay. And now he needs to raise some capital. How much capital does he have available to him down this route here? You know how these finance deals go. You get to the end of the 4 years, you hand back the keys, you walk away, or you put that in as a deposit on another car and you continue to pay £250 a month forever. He's got nothing, absolutely nothing. Not a single penny he can put down as a deposit on a house. But if you look at it this way, well, interestingly enough, during the first year of owning that car, because it's some kind of, I don't know, limited edition thing, he went to car shows with it. Is that a thing? Well, apparently. And twice he got offered £10,000 cash during the first year of owning that car. Which one is the slave? The borrower is slave to the lender. Never mind the fact that this route has cost you £5,000 less than the other route. At the end of it, you've got a £10,000 car. On that route, you own nothing. Okay, and yet this is the route. Remember last week we looked at the broad road, narrow road? This is the way that most people go. It's just a thing. Okay. Now, that's not all God has to say on the subject of debt. In the New Testament, he says this, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. It's the only debt a Christian should have, is the debt to love one another. And going back to the Old Testament again, look at this, my son, if you've shaken hands and pledged for a stranger, be cool about it, just be relaxed. Is that what it says? Free yourself from it, like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the snare of the fowler. Now, I'm sure we've all seen wildlife documentaries, yeah? All the gazelles standing around, eating grass, doing the gazelle kind of thing, and a cheetah bursts out the long grass. And you know how relaxed the gazelle are about life at this point, yeah? I'll be alright, I've got payment protection insurance, I'll be fine. Or do they run? That's the imagery God gives us to say, that's how you should think about debt. You should run the debt with the intensity, the energy that a gazelle escapes from the hand of the cheetah. Or a bird from the snare of the fowler. That's what God thinks about debt. Interesting. How to get out of debt if we're in debt. Okay, let's use this. I mean, this is just practical. This isn't in the Bible. This is just, you listen to what people are saying and read what people have to say, and this is how they say is the best way to tackle debt. So let's imagine we have a number of debts here, perhaps a credit card, a finance deal on a car, student loan, you know, whatever else. Okay. Any debt repayment is made up of two parts. There's principal, capital, and interest. The way to tackle this is really, really simple. Line them up in order, smallest to largest. Then reduce every payment so you're only paying the interest on them. Okay? Now, lenders will happily let us do this because as far as they're concerned, if we only repay the interest, the principal remains and they've got us slaves for the next 50 years. Okay? So they'll happily let you reduce everything till you're just paying the interest. And then what you do is you take off all of those capital payments and you apply them to the smallest debt until it's paid off. And then you take all of it, including the interest off that smallest one, and you apply it to the next one. Until that, can you see how much more snowball you've got? Every single time you get a more little thing, a store card, whatever else, this snowball gathers momentum. Go to the next one, look how much you've got now. But your horrible American term, leveraging against that debt, and this is how you get out of debt. Okay? Now, you may have noted and thought, hang on a second, I didn't mention mortgages. There's a reason for that. Mortgages work a little bit differently. Imagine I buy a car for £10,000. Okay? So, I don't know, put £3,000 or £4,000 down. And over the time that I am paying off that car, I've probably spent £13,000 to £14,000 on it. But what's happened to the value of the car during those years? It's gone the opposite way. And it's that gap between the two lines. You could quibble over the numbers, it wouldn't matter. It's the gap between the lines that equals poverty. Okay? Now let's have a look at what happens when I buy a house for £100,000 over a 25 or 30 year mortgage. Interestingly enough, I will probably pay double by the time I finish paying off the mortgage. More or less, ballpark figures, okay? But what will have happened to the value of the house? Now see, it's interesting that in the last 3 years, we did the sums on this the other day, a number of places in Kidderminster, house prices have risen by around 12% a year in the last 3 years. Now the national average is about 4 or 5%, but even so, cumulative interest, you add it up over 25, 30 years, your house will more than double numerically in value. So the two lines remain parallel, or in fact the residual value outstripped your payments. This, okay, it'd be better if you didn't have to have a mortgage. This is wise borrowing, as it were. The other one is not. There's a rule of thumb that says you should never borrow against a depreciating asset. And you should never borrow for a recurring payment either, but you know, there you go. Okay, so that's my mortgage is not included. So we need to think about getting out of debt. God clearly says that debt is not wise, it's not smart, it's not a good way to live our life. Even though everyone around us does their life this way, it doesn't mean that we have to, we should be different. Now, we need to do a little bit of adjustment. I have to make a confession. I put these in the wrong order because I had to fit them into the time we had available last week. This is the correct order. Think about this. Before we do anything else with our money, we have to get a budget working, because otherwise nothing else will work. Remember the analogy, it's like walking on the beach with handfuls of dry sand if you don't have a budget. It trickles through your fingers, you get to the end of the month, wow, where did the money go? I'm not quite sure how I spent it all. Getting on a budget is like wetting the sand, it's easier to get hold of your money. Secondly, use your budget to save up for rainy days, because, if you think about it, there isn't any point trying to get out of debt if we don't have enough reserves saved up to get us over speed bumps in life. Because you know what will happen, just about the time we start to get out of debt, the car will fail its MOT, and we've got no reserves, so we'll have to reach for the credit card and we're straight back into debt again. So there's a sequence to these, and that is the sequence. But equally, it'd be a bit odd to start saving up long term whilst still paying out to service debt. So there's a sequence. We have to get out of debt, then save life events, and then the last one is to invest for the future. Okay. We're going to look at three different ways of investing. First of all, pretty typical kind of thing. We buy stocks, we buy shares, we invest in property, or whatever else. Trouble is with investments, of course, they can go up as well as down. And that's why this only comes at the end, as the last step in building wealth, because if we haven't set everything else in place, if we haven't got out of debt, if we're not saving long term, we'd be foolish to start putting money into investment, because it could all go. You know, you put £10,000 into an investment, it might double, it might disappear completely. So you've got to be really, really careful with this. So typical investing is risky. But I want to show you two types of investments that are not at all risky. Here's the first. I went on the internet and I found this. This is a typical mortgage illustration for £100,000, just kept it to easy numbers so that we can actually count it up. Okay? Now if you look over here, you'll see that over the lifespan of that mortgage, we would pay back £170,000. But actually that's not quite true, because even to get this kind of interest rate, I'm having to pay arrangement fees. Now, arrangement fees are an absolutely brilliant wheeze for the bank. Because what do? We go and we pay an arrangement fee. It's only £1,000. I'll save more than £1,000. Yes, but what do we do with it? We haven't got the £1,000, have we? So we add it onto the mortgage. Which means that over the lifetime of the mortgage, it becomes £2,000. So every 2 years, we're paying up £2,000 to renegotiate our mortgage. Okay? And so, actually, it's probably closer to say, estimated, that by the end of 25, 30 years, we'll have paid back £190,000. And bear in mind that, of course, interest rates can't stay this low forever. The chances are they'll be higher. And so, you know, you talk to people in the industry and they say, yeah, well, if you borrow, you'll pay back double. Well, just think about that logically. If every pound I borrow costs me two, then every pound I pay into my mortgage saves me two. So if I get to the end of the month and I've got a bonus from work, I've got £100, I don't need it because I've budgeted for everything I really need. So why not turn it into £200 and put it into the mortgage? And what can start to happen over a period of time is that something really, really interesting will change about our mortgage. Imagine we take out a typical repayment mortgage, a 30 years. Now, what happens is, whatever our actual payment is each month, for half to two-thirds of the time period of the mortgage, most of that money is going to pay interest. Very little of it is actually going to pay off principal. But of course, if I take £1,000 at the end of the year and I pay it into my mortgage, every penny of that £1,000 comes off the principal. Which means that, if you just do a quick comparison, £1,000 in the long term saves me £8,000 if I pay off my principal at the start. Now obviously, the longer I go on, the less that actually makes a difference, which is why we use this simple analogy of every pound you pay in saves you two. But at the beginning, if you could pay £1,000 in that first year, it would make you £8,000. Is that an investment that's worth having? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so what they start to say is that realistically, anyone who takes this idea seriously and puts their bonuses in and puts a few hundred pounds extra a year in, most people will pay off a 25 to 30 year mortgage in 10 to 12 years. Now just hold on for a second, let's have a bit of emotional learning again. Just picture, I don't know how many of us have mortgages still or what those mortgages are, but picture going home from church today to find a letter on the map from your mortgage lender saying, "We're terribly sorry, but we've been taken over by another bank and your loan has been cancelled. Please don't send us any more money. We've written it off." Now just picture what you're going to do with that money next month, next year, 5 years from now. £500 a month, £6,000 a year. 2 years, £12,000. What are you going to do with £12,000? Go see the Grand Canyon? Travel around the world? Cut your working week to 4 days because you can afford to? But we've got to be intentional about this. Okay, so one last way of investing is this: to invest in the kingdom of heaven. Now there are two verses that go with this. And this is an interesting one. Luke 16, I'll tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when he's gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. And it's such a strange verse that I went and looked up several commentaries to get the idea behind it. And what it's saying is basically this: in this life, use our money, use our resources in such a way that people are brought into the kingdom of heaven. And then when we get to heaven, into the eternal dwellings, someone comes up to us and says, "You don't know me, but you sponsored a child in Africa through a Christian charity. That was me. And I'm here in heaven because of what you did. You don't know me, but do you remember you put that donation in that collecting tin? That took the gospel to me." You'll be welcomed by those people into eternal dwellings. And suddenly it changes its complexion, doesn't it? You see, as I promised, I'm not talking about tithing, I'm not talking about offerings. I'm talking about investing in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus also said it this way: store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. Store up, invest. Invest in the future, the real future. Because as we all know, no matter how smart we are investing in this life, no matter how quickly we pay off our mortgage, we get out of debt or anything else, life is short. And we can't take it with us when we go. Okay. So let's just wrap this up by recapping. First of all, we need to learn to live on a budget. I've used the analogy of wetting the sand so it doesn't trickle through our fingers. Secondly, save up for a rainy day, for those speed bumps of life, as it were. Next one is get out of debt. Flee like the gazelle from the hand of the hunter. Next one, save for the long term, whatever that dream is, whatever that ambition is, save up for that long term. And last but not least, invest. Now to bring this double message to a close, I want to look at three parables Jesus told. First of all, in Matthew 25, I think we're all pretty familiar with the parable of the sheep and the goats. Yeah? Does anyone have any doubt that this is a parable about judgment? No. Absolutely, it's a parable about judgment, and it tells us the criteria upon which we're going to be judged, doesn't it? Have we fed the poor? Have we done this? Have we? Okay, remember that verse we just read about those who will welcome us into the kingdom of heaven. It'll be the poor we've provided for. It'll be the hungry we've fed. It will be the desperate we've shared Jesus with. Okay, but then earlier in Matthew 25, there's another interesting parable which is usually misrepresented in the English Bible because it's called the parable of the talents. And we get the wrong idea about that because we think talent means that you have to sing in the church choir. But a talent is simply a unit of weight. And so a better way of representing the parable would be the parable of the kilograms. Yeah? And that's why in most modern translations they'll call it the parable of the bags of gold. Because you know the story. A king goes away and he hands out this money to his people. Have you noticed that this is also a parable about judgment? Well, think about how it ends. Take the one who didn't do anything useful with the money, tie him hand and foot, and cast him into outer darkness where there's weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. What does that sound like? Yeah? It's a parable about judgment. And again, we're given the criteria. What have you done with the money God gave you? And then just in case we didn't get the message, pretty much the same parable is told over in Luke 19, but there are differences. See, when we read these parables in different Gospels and they're told a little bit differently, it's really, really simple. What happens is Jesus went from place to place and he had a good story and he told it again and again and again. But being a master teacher, he differentiated his teaching for the audience he was speaking to. And so in one place he talks about talents, bags of gold. Presumably he's talking to a wealthy audience who can understand that. Now when he goes to this place in Luke 19, maybe it's just ordinary people. And so here he talks about a king going away and this guy hands out 10 coins, 10 minas, which by the way is also again a measure of weight and is always used in financial terms. But he hands out these 10 coins to 10 different people. And he says, do something with that money while I'm away. And when he comes back again, we find that it's a parable about judgment. Because again, there's a differentiating between those who have invested that and made more money for the kingdom and those who have not. Interesting, in all three parables, it's a parable about judgment. We're given the criteria by which we're judged. And it's a simple binary outcome. There's no middle ground. You're either in or you're out. Sheep, goats, praised and given more, or cast into outer darkness. It's very, very simple. And the message of these three parables is the same. There will be a judgment. We will one day stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And we will have to give account for what we have done. And one of the sets of questions, Section B in the exam paper will be, what have you done with the money I gave you? Have we done what most people do, which ultimately is to make the banks richer, make the finance companies better off? Or have we used our resources for the kingdom of heaven? It's a sobering thought, isn't it? Are we going to be like everyone else? Are we going to live our lives financially like everyone else? Or are we going to do things differently? That's the challenge I'll leave with you.